This is episode 12 of the Next Year Now podcast.
Hi, I'm Tyson Weinert, a creativity and innovation enthusiast. If you want to supercharge your creativity and innovation at work or in life, then you need to start listening to Next Year Now podcast with my friend Tom Hefner.
I think that recovery piece, both at work and outside of work, is one of the first things to go by the wayside. And it's really one of the most important pieces, not only to preventing burnout, but really to building your resilience too.
Welcome to the Next Year Now podcast with Tom Hefner. Tom believes that if you really want to thrive at work and in life, then every day purposeful habits and practices are vital. The Next Year Now podcast will not only help you identify and integrate these habits into your daily life, but also bring you key insights and lessons from some of the most successful people in their fields. And here is your host, Tom Hefner.
Hello and welcome to the podcast devoted to helping you thrive at work and in life. The topic of habits and practices is always front and center in our discussion, but we also explore how we use these habits and practices to improve our personal development, productivity, creativity, health and well-being, business, and entrepreneurship. Today, you and I have a wonderful opportunity to learn how we can prevent burnout in the workplace and how to cultivate resilience. That's because we get to hear from Paula Davis Lack, a stress and resilience expert. Her tips for habits and practices we can adopt right now are going to help you thrive at work and in life. In our conversation, Paula and I will be discussing what burnout at work looks like and why it's so devastating to our health and well-being, the most effective habits to prevent burnout and to build our resilience, some great book recommendations to help us learn more about the science of burnout prevention and resilience, and so many more insights and practical tools to help us. Look, Paula Davis Lack is a real tour de force. I don't have enough time to introduce you to all the things she's accomplished in her career, but what I will tell you is this. She's a former practicing lawyer who left the profession after a severe bout with workplace burnout. And since then, she's studied the subject of burnout prevention and resilience probably more than anyone I know. She's developed the expertise and the practical knowledge to go with that by teaching resilience skills to professionals all around the world, okay? Part of that experience included teaching resilience skills to Army soldiers and their families. And I've seen firsthand the positive effect that she's had on these soldiers and family members. And it's simply transformational. And if that wasn't enough, Paula has become a thought leader in the area of burnout prevention and resilience by becoming a recognized writer on places like the Huffington Post, Forbes, Fast Company, and Psychology Today, to name a few. She's also been featured in and on the Oprah Magazine, Redbook, Time.com, Today.com, Women's Health Magazine, heck, the Steve Harvey TV show, Huffington Post Live, and a variety of other media outlets. Paula, thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm so excited to be here and chat about two of my favorite topics.
Likewise, I am too. Today is going to be a really great discussion. We'll be covering some fantastic habits and practices we can all adopt to prevent burnout and to improve our resilience. That's what I'm dying to learn, and I know you are too. But before we do, I'd love for us to get to know Paula better. Paula, where did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
Sure. So I grew up in a very small town in southeastern Wisconsin called Walworth. So Walworth, population 1,607. So very small. And I always think of the book, It Takes a Village. And that's how I would describe my childhood because I lived across the street from my grandparents. I lived 7 miles away from my other set of grandparents. And we knew literally like every single neighbor for blocks. So it was nice in the sense that, I always felt like I had people who were looking out for me and who really cared about how I was doing and how my well-being was. It didn't work so well when I was trying to sneak back into my house in my teen years one night, and the chief of police happened to be our next door neighbor.
Oh no.
And I got pulled over in our driveway and by a different police officer. And I thought I could get away with it until the chief of police happened to mention something to my dad the next day. So I had not planned to say anything until my dad kind of asked me about what happened last night. And so I was busted. But largely I feel just really blessed to have kind of grown up in the environment that I did. My high school was also fairly small, although, you know, we've had some amazing people graduate from my high school. Most notably, if for all of you football fans out there, the starting center for the Dallas Cowboys is Travis Frederick. My high school. So, cool. Yes. And for also for people who, if you use Keekaman soy sauce is bottled in a plant in my hometown. So if you read the label, you will see Walworth, Wisconsin, zip code 53184 on the back of your bottle.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I mean, I remember growing up, my dad was in the Marine Corps, and so we tended to have very tight-knit communities. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for better or worse, maybe because people, you know, a lot more parents, both parents work nowadays, it seems, at least in my experience, now granted, I only have two data points, which is we used to live in a townhome and now we live in a single family home. But it seems like people, the communities are less tight knit and they know each other less. That's one of the reasons actually we moved to the single family home and the community we moved to last year, because we wanted to find that. We wanted to find that tight knit community. So that's really cool that you got to experience that.
It's so amazing. And I think that's one of the things that I'm thinking about now as we have an 18 month old, and as she grows up, you know, thinking the same thing, like, are we in the right community? Should we move to a smaller town? Should we move to a different part of the town that we're currently in?
You know, before striking out on your own and becoming a leading expert in burnout prevention and resilience, you practiced law. So what was that experience like, and what led you to leave your law practice behind and change careers?
So I joke that I'm a recovering lawyer, and I think I'll probably be recovering for a long, long time. So there was no real rhyme or reason for why I went to law school. I had taken some constitutional law classes in my undergrad program and just thought it would be an interesting next step because my degree is actually in psychology. And I didn't want to sort of follow the pathological sort of mental illness side of psychology, and just thought, okay, what am I going to study when I go on in my schooling? And law sounded interesting to me. So I practiced commercial real estate law for about 7 years. So I was in a large law firm, and then I was in-house at a really large company. And I practiced during the 2000s. So that was the huge real estate boom. So both on the residential and the commercial side, anyone who wanted to build something or buy something could get a loan or was able to make that happen. And we all know how that turned out. But for those years, we were super, super busy. I mean, I just was beyond busy with the amount of work that I had. And I actually burned out during what became the last year or year and a half of my law practice. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't know there was a name for it. I just knew that I was, for some reason, not able to handle my stress in the same way that I felt I always could have. And really then became interested in thinking about, okay, so I'm going through this process. What is it, and how can I help other busy professionals not have to experience what I've just gone through for the last year or so? And that really just opened my eyes to thinking about, you know, what could that look like? Should I start my own business? Should I go back to school? What would that, in what kind of degree, you know, should I get? And that's really what led me to the positive psychology program at the University of Pennsylvania. And really just loved all that I learned there. And when we first started to study resilience with Karen Rivich, I went, oh my God, this is like so if I had this back when I was a law student or even before that, wow, I would have thought about challenges differently. I would have experienced stress in a different way, and just really, really became passionate about that topic and devoted to wanting to learn more about it and how to teach it to other people.
Yeah. And you did, right? I mean, you went on to teach workshops and kind of learn probably through Karen, right?
Yeah. And it was just really fortunate and blessed to be part of the Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness program that I know you were part of as well when I graduated, and got to spend about 3.5 years or so teaching resilience skills as part of the UPenn team, you know, to drill sergeants and officers and other soldiers and spouses and their family members, and really got to see firsthand how, you know, people who use these tools and have this skill set really do some great things in their lives.
I think what's great about that, teaching military families and military service members, is that, you know, by definition, by nature, they have a pretty tough job at times, right? Yeah. And especially having grown up with my dad was in the Marine Corps, I can appreciate how tough it was. So I always thought, well, you know, if you can teach military service members and their families to be resilient, you can teach anybody to be resilient.
Well, and what's interesting is I hear this a lot, because I often, when I'm talking, I do most of my work in the legal profession. I do some work in healthcare, but I'm working a lot with lawyers who are a very skeptical and urgent population of people. And that's one of the things that oftentimes I will hear comments about, and folks will say, you know, this data is great, but thank you. I'm a lawyer. What do soldiers have in common with lawyers? You know, if you think more broadly, you know, and it's not just folks in the legal profession, but I think a lot of people who are working today are working under very strict time pressures and deadlines, mm-hmm. especially with lawyers and folks in healthcare. You don't have a lot of wiggle room. You have to get things right, and you have to get them right fairly perfectly, fairly quickly. And so there's not a lot of room for error. And so I think there's a lot of similarities in that sense between the military and the legal profession and folks who are in healthcare and doing other jobs. So I like to point that out. I also hear a lot of lawyers, especially because lawyers are in such an adversarial system, talking about, oh, you know, we've got to go to war with the other side, and, you know, using some kind of military metaphors. So I think there are definite parallels.
I know from my own experience too. So before I kind of got into human-centered design thinking work, so some years ago, I used to work on crew systems out in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we built jammer systems that would protect soldiers and Humvees and other vehicles to protect them from improvised explosive devices. And so that was one of those times where, and that was actually right around the time that I became interested in positive psychology and went on to pursue that at UPenn like you did. But it was kind of the same thing, right? We were under some really intense deadlines. Sometimes we would get a request from the military theater and somebody would say, hey, we need something in 2 weeks, right? And so our engineering team would have to turn it around fast, and then turn it around with the expectation that, look, you know, what you do right now is could potentially save a life or, you know, cost a life. So that's where, for me, when I was going through the unit on resilience and reading more about that, I was like, oh my God, if I had had this, right, that would have been a lot easier to, you know, manage my team and lead my team a little bit better, hope, you know, at the time.
Right. Absolutely. No, I agree. And I think what you're bringing up too is how critical I think resilience is to leadership. I've started to talk about resilience really as a core leadership competency with the folks who I talk to, you know, I think it informs so much of the way that people lead. And if you have a bad day or you're thinking in a counterproductive way, how do you get yourself out of that, you know, so that you can, you know, work with your team and influence your team in a meaningful way?
I 100% agree. And what I found, it's almost like being a parent, right? You can tell your kids, hey, do this, do that. But your kids really respond and model, respond and mimic what you do, right? So
absolutely.
If I want my kids to be kind and compassionate, then I should show them and model that, be kind and compassionate. And I see the same thing, you know, working as a project manager and as a leader within my organization, that I can tell them, I can give them that guidance, I can coach them. But the best thing that I can do is I can model that behavior and model that, you know, that resilience for them to mimic.
Without question. Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about burnout prevention and what that is and resilience. You know, Paula's current career is focused on burnout prevention and resilience, as she was talking about. Given how busy we all are today, juggling work, family time, trying to find some time to exercise. Man, I struggle with that. Struggling to keep up with friends and family, all the things that demand our time and attention. I really can't think of two better skills for us to cultivate and improve than burnout prevention and resilience. Paula, talk if you would about what burnout prevention is and what resilience is. You know, what do they mean and why should we care?
Sure. And so what I like to do whenever I get these types of questions is really kind of focus from the definitions of each. So what are we really talking about when we talk about burnout? How do we define what it is? And the way that I think about burnout, and I've sort of culled my definition from a number of different spots, but I think of it as a process of chronic exhaustion, cynicism, and ineffectiveness that's caused by an imbalance in your demands, your resources, and your recovery. So it's a long definition, and there's a lot to unpack with that. But I think that one of the biggest things to think about with burnout is that it doesn't just happen overnight. You don't just wake up one day and go, woo, I'm burned out. You know, we have very busy days, very busy weeks, very busy months. And just because we're busy and we're tired and we're worn out doesn't necessarily mean that we're actually burned out. I think we use the term burned out kind of loosely in our culture. And, you know, while there's no bright line test to say, well, if you've been feeling this way for 6 months, then it must mean that you're burned out. We can't put a pinpoint on it like that, but it's really noticing that it's more likely than not, or more often than not, you're feeling this sense of especially emotional exhaustion. You're feeling cynical, like other people and other things are just bugging you or rubbing you the wrong way. If you're somebody who interacts with clients or patients, you've sort of detached from them, so you're losing some empathy. You start to think of them as just another deal or just another case coming through the door. And then feeling ineffective is sort of self-explanatory. Like, you're kind of wondering, like, what am I doing here? And am I really doing the best job that I can? Am I as effective as I could be? So those exhaustion, cynicism, and ineffectiveness are really the three big dimensions of burnout. And then the imbalance piece in the demands, resources, and recovery is the kind of the second half. It's sort of the formula for burnout. So demands are just simply things that take consistent effort and energy about your work or about, you know, your non-work. Resources are the motivational things that put energy back and give you energy back. And recovery is just, how are you recharging your batteries? And to your point about the fact that we're all juggling so much, I think that that recovery piece, both at work and outside of work, is one of the first things to go by the wayside. And it's really one of the most important pieces, not only to preventing burnout, but really to building your resilience too.
Help us ground this in why this is important in terms of, you know, if we don't pay attention to burnout, what are some of the risks to our health, to our life, to our work, to our relationships, anything?
Sure. I can speak to this in a number of different ways. And I'll start by talking to you a little bit more about my own experience burning out. So one of the things that I did wrong during this process is I didn't say anything about it. So I understand the mentality so well with professionals who don't want to say anything. You don't want to out yourself as kind of like the weak person. And, you know, then all of a sudden you're pigeonholed, maybe you're thought of differently by your boss or by your team. And so you keep it to yourself. And because I didn't really know what I was experiencing and I didn't have maybe words to put behind it, that was another piece of why I didn't say much either. But what happened then is that I didn't get the help that I needed, whether that be professional help, whether that be being, you know, connected to a coach or somebody who would have helped me that way. And I started to notice things like, you know, I was always the person who wanted to get people together for lunch and, you know, get everyone together. And instead, I really just was like, please leave me alone. I need to sit in my office and close the door and just get some peace. And so I noticed things like that changing. I started to get panic attacks. So that we know that the more that, you know, burnout goes unchecked, it doesn't just alleviate itself and get better, it gets worse. And so some people who are experiencing burnout are also experiencing depression. Some people take up excessive drinking or substance abuse type issues. Other people's anxiety spikes, which is what happened to me. It can interfere with your relationships too, because like I remember just, you know, feeling thankful and relieved that it was the weekend and I didn't have to work as much. And then, you know, my husband would say, hey, let's go out and, you know, hang out with our friends on Saturday. We haven't seen them for a while. And my response was, oh my God, I just want, you know, like a glass of red wine and some bad reality television. And I just want to veg out because I just don't have any excess left over in the tank, you know. And so then he'd be bummed out, or he'd go out without me, and then they'd ask questions about where I was. And, you know, it was just all of that. And so your relationships do kind of take a hit because you just don't have as much kind of left in the tank to sort of deal with that.
I noticed from my own experience when I was going through this, we would go on vacation. We would go on like a 2 or 3 week vacation, and then coming back to work was, it felt like the most Herculean task I've ever done. And those first, you know, first few days, but let's be honest, it was the first few weeks back. I was just, it was almost inconsolable, right? I just had to like somehow drag myself back into it. And it was just really, really, really difficult. And that's when I realized, oh yeah, there's something else wrong here.
Yeah, and the other thing, so that works both ways. So you mentioned the vacation piece. And so one of the things that I noticed is when I would finally get away for an extended period of time, which wasn't very often, and that was one of the other things that I didn't do well. But when I did, it's like if I was gone for a week, it would take me like 2 or 3 days. Like I would just literally veg out and want to do nothing. And so like my family and my, you know, everyone was off sort of like doing activities and going down by the beach and hanging out and having fun. And I was just like, please leave me alone, because it took that long for my body to simply sort of like disconnect and reset itself. Because I was so stressed, and then I'm missing out on part of the vacation. And then you're right, when you go back to work, there's that transition in the way that you described as well. And one of the big messages that I like to talk to leaders and folks, you know, at higher levels in organizations is, if somebody says, I'm really stressed out or I'm feeling burned out, don't suggest, hey, just take Friday off or just go on vacation, because it's really just a temporary Band-Aid. It's not anything that's really going to fix the problem if somebody is actually burned out. And there's a couple of decent studies that show, yeah, your burnout does alleviate and does get better when you go on vacation, but it bounces right back to where it was within, I think they think, you know, about a week or two of when you get back to work. So it's really just a temporary fix.
Yeah, I'll yes and that one. Look, if you found yourself shaking your head in agreement when Paula was just describing burned out, you know, being burned out at work, you know, or what it feels like when you don't have that resilience to push forward, I was talking about that a little bit, then I want you to lock your attention on the next few questions I have for Paula. I guarantee you that what she has to say here is going to be extremely important for how you can prevent burnout and improve your resilience, both of which will help you to thrive at work and in life. Paula, when you reflect on your time, you know, researching burnout prevention strategies and coaching individuals or organizations, what have been the most effective habits and practices to prevent burnout?
You can look at this in a couple of different ways. And so one of the big messages that I want to make sure people leave with too, and one of the big things that I always try to get across to organizations who bring me in, is I think the mentality of the organization is often fix my people. If you can just do some, you know, training and workshops and coaching with my people, that will fix the problem. And the research is very, very clear that burnout is not just an individual issue. It is also very much an organizational issue. So there are things within the organization, whether it be like a values issue or a systems issue or a culture issue, that are driving the burnout problem as well. And so we know very clearly that, you know, giving people some individual strategies will help, and that's really important. Organizations also have to think about what can we do from an organizational standpoint to really help address and deal with this problem. And so from an organizational standpoint, it's been shown that things like giving positive and regular feedback is important to people. It's all of, you know, the self-determination theory of DC and Ryan's research about, and it's huge, letting people have a sense of autonomy. So have some sort of say or control over projects that they take or how their day unfolds to the extent that's possible. Giving them a sense of challenge, you know, let them work on projects and stretch assignments that are going to help them develop current skills and new skills. And then really giving them a sense of connection and helping them understand not only how to develop high quality relationships with other people, but letting them know how they fit into their teams and their organizations and giving them that sense of belonging. So those are kind of really important clusters of things for organizations to look at. From an individual standpoint, it's things like tracking what I talked about earlier. What are your job demands, and really understanding where are you spending consistent effort and energy? And these aren't bad things. These are things like answering email, developing new business, talking with my colleagues, the physical actual doing of the work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Just things that happen on a regular basis. Understanding where are your job resources? So the motivational aspects of your job. What are they? Do you have enough of them? If you don't, how can you get more of them? And then really paying attention to how you are recharging your batteries both at work and outside of work. So it's that cluster of things. And then really, I think this is going to naturally lead us into a little bit more of a discussion about resilience, but it's how do you build your resilience to stress? How do you kind of develop that toolkit or that skill set that's going to help you deal with the change and the adversity and the challenge that you might experience on a regular basis?
Yeah. So great segue. I mean, what are some of those successful strategies that we can use to develop and improve our resilience?
Sure. So I like to think of, and you had asked this earlier, but I like to define or think of resilience as your capacity for stress-related growth. So it's not just enough to figure out how do I bounce back from a challenging situation or these everyday hassles or stressors that I have to deal with, but it's what can I learn from it and how can I go forward in a more meaningful and a better way. And so from a skills standpoint, I really clump them into three different categories. So one category that I talk about is what I call think differently. So how can you reframe counterproductive thinking? How do you develop sort of that mental agility so that you can key in on different perspectives and kind of go into that problem solving mode quicker instead of being locked down and stewing about an event or something that happened? The second kind of big cluster or clump is what I call connect more. So how do you develop high quality relationships with the people who are important to you in your life? And then the third clump is what I call thrive. And so it's sort of my little catch-all category for how do you develop the meaning and purpose behind what you're doing? How do you stay engaged and motivated and energized with what you're doing? And so the skills that I teach generally fall into one or more of those particular categories. So I have a number of them. It just depends on how you would like me to talk about them.
What about kind of dive in or maybe an example or two within helping people find kind of meaning and purpose?
Sure. So one of my favorite exercises is from Kelly McGonigal's book, The Upside of Stress, which I absolutely love. And that's one of the books that I would put out for people who are thinking about this topic a little bit more. But one of the things she talks about is creating a bigger than self goal. So I think we all kind of know, or at least have viewed, you know, what is our job description for attorneys? It's how many billable hours do I need? You have those sort of nuts and bolts aspects about your job and what you need to do. But this is sort of looking bigger picture. So you can ask yourself, what do I want to contribute to the world? What kind of change do I want to create? What kind of positive impact do I want to have? And this isn't talked about a lot in organizations. And I often tell the story that when I was doing one of the Army resilience trainings, there was a soldier at my table. He was kind of early on in the training, so I didn't really know him very well, but he was kind of staring at me in a weird way. And finally, I just said, "Hey, Sergeant, what's up?" And he looked at me and he said, "Are you just in this for a paycheck?" Which is a pretty bold question.
That is a very bold question.
Somebody, but no one has ever asked, had really in my career at all, had ever asked me about that. And I was able to tell him, you know, this is really meaningful work to me because of, you know, I relayed a story about my grandpa and how he didn't get the help he needed after World War II. And that kind of set our family off in a different way. And once he heard that story, he was bought in. He was bought into me and he understood why I was there. So really almost immediately then he started to ask me questions. He would pull me aside to make sure he had understood concepts. So our relationship really shifted because I was able to kind of big picture tell him, no, I'm not just in this for the money. This is really important to me and here's why. And I think it's so important for organizations today to really understand that, because especially when it comes to, I hear so much about how do I manage millennials and how are we dealing with millennials? They are so, so focused on, you know, you got to be upfront with me and tell me where is the meaning and purpose in what I'm doing, because if you can't or you won't, I'm going to go look for it somewhere else. So I think one of the areas we talk about the least, but I think is one of the most important pieces of really resilience and happiness and well-being and thriving and burnout prevention and what have you.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You talk about millennials. We had this conversation at work when we're working on a project for leadership development, and people lamented the fact that millennials, you know, they just want everything now. And then, and one of the things I said was, it's not that they want everything now or that they don't want to put their time in. It's exactly what you just said. It's that they have less patience for not doing something meaningful. And they're not, and you have, they have more opportunities and more avenues to pursue it. So in other words, that is to say, if they're at a job and it's clear that either A, it's not meaningful work, or they're just doing it for the sake of doing it, and that's why their boss is telling them to do, you know, some task, they'll roll out of there and find another opportunity, or they'll go to a different group, or it, you know what I mean? And I think that's really, it speaks to the importance now more than ever of meaning and purpose in our work.
It's that, and also the meaning and purpose piece, coupled with the fact that they're the most transparent generation. I mean, they've grown up with everything's on the internet. You can find information about anything now. And for me, I mean, you know, I'm not that old. I mean, the internet was around when I was practicing law, but people used it in a different way. And there wasn't necessarily that first thought of, wow, I'm unhappy at this particular firm. Let me just go online and Google like different firms or different, you know, legal careers and have all of this information pop up. Mm. That's what they do now. You can find out anything about anything right now online. And so it's not hard for them to go, okay, I'm not happy here. I'll just do a few Google searches and talk to some people and I can have ideas for, you know, 10 different directions to go after this. So it's the transparency piece too.
What are some tips or habits for us when we're, sometimes I'll see this with people I work with or people that I coach at work where something bad happens and then they just kind of start circling the drain, for lack of a better phrase. And how do we build that? How do they build that resilience?
Yeah, this has been, for me personally, the most helpful aspect of my own resilience practice is understanding really how my brain thinks in the wild and how I can kind of harness it so that it can maybe go in a better direction. Because, boy, is there a lot going on up there, especially when things, you know, are difficult and I have a hard time dealing with the situation. So there's a few things that people can do. So one of the quick strategies that I teach is a mindfulness technique called STOP. And in addition to some of the longer skills I teach, I like to try and give people as many strong strategies. So that's my acronym for stress resilience on the go. How can I give you like little nuggets of things that you can, you know, either incorporate real time or start using really, really quickly? And so it's a technique called STOP. And so it's an acronym. And the S in STOP stands for stop, which I think violates the rules of acronyms, but that's what it is. The T is to take a breath or just take a couple of quick breaths. We know that, you know, having some sort of a breathing practice can really help just sort of center you quickly. The O is observe. So just very quickly do a scan physiologically. Where are you feeling the stress? And then the P is to proceed. So it's stop, take a breath, observe, and proceed. So it's meant to just really be this very, very quick pause, sort of a reset button, both mental and physiological, that, you know, if you're circling the drain, as you said, it's maybe just enough just to kind of get you sort of moving in a different direction and your brain onto something else. So that's a very, 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 very quick tip. One of my favorite questions to help people reframe a challenge or an adversity is, where do I have a measure of control, influence, or leverage in the situation? Mm. And so that oftentimes is one question that I will ask myself when I feel stuck or I feel like I'm circling the drain. And it's interesting because I just had this conversation with a friend of mine who I talked to a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, we were about 10 minutes into the conversation and he said, you know what, I'm really upset. You know, he just bought a house and then realized that the house behind his house was up for sale. And the house behind the house he bought is the one that he really wants.
No.
Yeah. And so he just was talking about how it's like got everything that I've, you know, always wanted and I'm kind of upset now. And so I just really let it go. We talked for another 10 minutes and he brought it up again. And I'm like, okay, where do you have a measure of control or influence in this situation? And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, I don't have any. And I said, well, you do. I said, you could put an offer in on this other house. You're going to have to move again, even though you just moved in the last 4 weeks. You know, you're going to have to, you know, go through this whole entire process again. You're probably going to lose money on the house that you just purchased because you're going to have to sell it. You know, so we really talked through it and he realized that those options, while in his control, weren't things that he wanted to do or weren't realistic. And so I said, okay, you have to figure out what can you control or influence. If you ID that and then understand or realize those aren't things you can or want to do, then you got to let it go. And that's easier said than done. But here's how our thinking influences not only undercutting our resilience, but also driving burnout, is that we spend an inordinate amount of energy focused on trying to change things that aren't changeable or trying to influence things that we can't influence. And so the quicker you can shift into, gosh, there's really nothing I can do about this, I got to let it go, or identifying, yeah, here's one or two things I can do, and then going in that direction, it saves us a lot of energy and time, but it also helps our brains just kind of like get a handle on on where we're at. So those are two very quick techniques.
And I think what's interesting about those techniques is that asking yourself the question of what's in my measure of control, or using that acronym to kind of, you know, literally stop, is both of them kind of give you the opportunity to slow down your thinking.
Yes.
Which then helps you, you know, there's that immediate maybe physiological response that you have, or kind of lizard brain response that you have, but at least you have a chance to slow down. And I think that's what's always been helpful for me, is the ability to slow down my thinking a little bit.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's lots of other different questions that people can ask themselves to reframe stress or reframe a challenge or reframe their thinking when it's acting in a counterproductive way. And you know, just where do you have control or influence or leverage is simply one of those questions. And it's just one that I happen to find most beneficial, but there, you know, but there are others that I teach. And I think it's just so important for us to be able to identify when is our thinking working for us and when is it not working for us. And when it's not, how do I get out of that quicker? So I don't get stuck.
Very true. And it has been true in my case as well. Paula, you've shared some awesome ideas for habits and practices we can, to develop right now. But if I wanted to dive deeper into both burnout prevention and resilience, what tools, resources, articles, maybe even books would you recommend? I know you talked about the upside of stress, but maybe, you know, some of the other tools, articles, or even books that you've written.
Sure. The upside of stress is fantastic. I've written several eBooks, and one of the eBooks that I would recommend people maybe download, and it's free, is just my ebook called A Strong, Stress Relief Strategies When You Have 10 Minutes or Less. So it's, again, really my attempt to give people meaningful research-based little nuggets that they can start to incorporate in their really, really busy lives, whether it's at work or whether it's non-work. On the burnout side, what's interesting is that there aren't a ton of books, and the ones that have been written are usually take a little bit more of a research focus. One that I actually like a fair amount, it's called The Truth About Burnout, but it's by the two sort of leading researchers in the area, Christina Maslach and Michael Leiter. The other person that I would direct people to, and again, this is a little bit more of a researchy academic focus, but a wonderful researcher in Europe, his name is Arnold Baker. It's two K's, but his website is his name. And he's got just a ton of really great resources and information on his website, not only about burnout, but also, you know, researchers in this field have kind of gotten to the point where we go, yep, there's burnout. We know what's causing it. And sort of, here's what it is. Let's focus our attention on how to kind of alleviate it. And so he's got some interesting resources and studies, especially on both parts of the equation.
Okay, cool. Oh, you know, one thing I didn't kind of circle back on, which was, let's just say we're not circling the drain, right? And we're in a good spot. What are different ways, or what are different habits that we can develop to look at problems or challenges or adversities differently, right? To think differently, just taking that step back, right? We're not talking about in the moment, but just kind of throughout our life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you can look at a situation through a different lens or through a different perspective and be able to harness that quickly, I think that's helpful. I mean, I guess for me, I still go back to those like reframe questions, because you can be all happy and resilient and going along just fine, and you know, maybe one domain of your life is an area, you know, maybe you got it all together at work, but maybe home is a little bit challenging or vice versa, you know. And one of the things that I find with a lot of people who I work with, and this is like me to a T, is that I'm so hard on myself, I'm like so great with everybody else and comforting and kind and all of that, but I beat myself up a ton. And really just thinking about, you know, the question, what would I tell a friend or a family member if they were going through the same adversity? You know, whereas I would say to myself, oh my God, you suck. And how could you do that? And, you know, what were you really thinking? But I would never tell a friend or a family member that. So I guess thinking about that from a different perspective.
What else am I missing when it comes to burnout prevention or resilience? You know, what else should we know that might be critical for us to prevent burnout or to improve our resilience?
One of the biggest messages or takeaways that I would say to people is, if you think you're sort of headed in the direction of burnout, or you're just noticing that you're not able to handle your stress as well, say something. Whether it's like calling me or, you know, reaching out to a friend or talking to your boss, it feels really vulnerable to do that. And you do have to take into account, especially at work, you know, the dynamics of your team and your situation. But it's so much easier to address burnout the earlier you catch it. And it becomes a much, much different conversation down the road. So the techniques, the resilience techniques that I use really help on the prevention side, or the, you know, I'm just starting to notice that maybe there's an issue, what can I do? But some of the things that I talk about really aren't effective if you are kind of where I was. You know, you're having panic attacks on a daily basis, or you're feeling also depressed, or, you know, those are things where, you know, a call to a mental health professional or your physician, or having to have a more serious conversation about, gosh, is this, you know, work what I really want to be doing, or is this workplace a good fit for me? Those are heavier conversations that entail potentially change of life type stuff. And those are more likely the conversations you need to have when you're as far gone as I was, to kind of get yourself pulled back. So really, the sooner you can address it, it's really one of those things, the sooner that you can address, the better.
And we talk a lot about habits and practices on our show. I mean, it's why this show exists. I'm a huge believer in the power of habits and practices. One habit that I consider to be paramount is the habit of reading. So I want to take a few minutes to dive in and talk books. Paula, if you reflect on the last few years, what are the two or three books that have had the biggest influence on you, and why?
It's so funny because I tell my friends I have a book buying problem and I need to develop a book reading problem. No, I do a fair amount of reading, but my book buying has outpaced my reading. Earlier, I mentioned Kelly McGonigal's book, The Upside of Stress. That's really my go-to book about how I think about stress and building resilience to stress. Really, for me, anything by Brené Brown. So especially her book, Daring Greatly, and The Gifts of Imperfection. Those two books have really, really just, I mean, transformed the way that I think about what she calls being in the arena and having that sense of vulnerability and having the conversations that you need to have about things and saying the things that you really should say to those that you love and those that you work with, and really how just thinking about that and how much, again, sort of our thinking about that type of stuff gets in our way. And the other book is written by Charles Duhigg, which is called The Power of Habit.
Yes, I love that book.
It's so great. And I start to build that into my presentations now, in his little, you know, cue, reward, whatever the three-part system is that he talks about, really has opened my eyes and made me look at not only how can I develop better habits, but the habits that I have that aren't so great, how can I start to manipulate some parts of the system that he talks about so I can go in a better direction.
So you talked about having a book buying problem or habit. If I visited your house right now, what would I find on your bookshelf that you're waiting to read or try, you know, reading in the next few weeks or months?
Well, you would think that I was sort of the biggest like self-help, probably like in need of it. I just have so many different like frames of self-help type books all over the place. One of the books that I'm about to read, I just started it, is called Irresistible, and it is by Adam Alter. One of the questions that I get a lot from my audiences is around technology and how technology is sort of influencing burnout and causing people to be less resilient. But he has just compiled, it's just a wonderful book with a number of different studies talking about the role of technology in our lives and how we're, you know, literally getting hooked on our devices and what that all means. So that's a big one that I have that I'm about to read right now. And I, as we've discussed sort of offline, I'm really into this whole notion of design thinking and innovation. And so I now have a number of books on design thinking that I need to dig into as well. So
awesome. Well, I'm definitely going to read The Irresistible.
Yeah. And the last book too that I wanted to plug and tell you in terms of reading is called The Telomere Effect. So it's a really great book if you're interested in learning more about how stress impacts us, because there's just these brilliant researchers who wrote this book who have found that stress impacts us down to the cellular level, and that our telomeres are these non-coding segments of DNA that actually shorten and lengthen depending on basically how we live. And so people who get really stressed out or stay stressed and can't develop their resilience to stress can develop shorter telomeres. And what that means is that they literally are aging quicker than folks who are able to kind of manage their stress or build more resilience in that capacity. So I just found that fascinating. Like, we think about big picture, how is this impacting our work or how is this impacting our family? But really, at a cellular level, it's impacting how well we are aging and how healthy we are.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. I've always been really fascinated by the physiological relationships that we have to the things that we do or experience in our life. So I think that'll be, like you, I'm very good at the book buying, not always good at the book reading, but I endeavor to do better.
As do we all.
What's next for you? What are you working on that you're really excited about?
I am really excited. I have some interesting folks who I'm collaborating with in a number of different projects, and I'm really excited to be hopefully doing some more research in this area, really nuts and bolts research in the area of burnout prevention, specifically with lawyers in the legal profession. There is so much that's happening in healthcare now in this area. And one of the things that we talked about earlier that I didn't mention was all about in healthcare, the issue is being taken so seriously because of the link to burnout and malpractice issues and patient safety issues. Mm. And so that's a big kind of connection that I want to also make too within the legal profession. So really, you know, there are numerous studies that come out each year in healthcare around burnout, and there's just scant little research about its impact in the legal profession. So really, really wanting to dive into, you know, creating more of a research basis for this. So yeah, I'm excited about that.
That is really fantastic. Paula, thank you so much for taking the time out to do this interview. It's been a real pleasure, and I think a gift for us to hear your wisdom.
Thank you so much. I was just so excited and thrilled to be talking with you today.
Likewise. You can connect with Paula online through a variety of ways. Her Twitter handle is @PaulaDavisLack, and her website is PaulaDavisLack.com. That is PaulaDavisLack.com. All the links and resources Paula and I discussed, including the link to her free ebook, Strong, can be found at the page created just for this episode. You'll find it all at nextyearnowpodcast.com/12. And finally, just a reminder, if you like the show and enjoy learning from our guests each week, please consider giving us a rating and a review on iTunes. It helps us stay relevant and findable by listeners like you. That's it for today, and I'll see you next time.